Welcome to the world today. Now, welcome again to the World Today broadcast. This is Frank Weltner. I have so much fun bringing you these broadcasts because I find the news about Jews to be extremely interesting and somewhat humorous. Although sometimes it does seem to be, well, a little sick. Let's take, for instance, an article that was published just today in the Post-Gazette. And it's about a family that has not been a very good neighbor. It's in Pennsylvania in Luzerne Township. The family is a Jewish family called, their last name is the Barbers. The Barber family says that neighborhood antagonists have poisoned their dogs, defaced their property with swastikas, and tried to burn down their house. They claim they're under attack because they're Jewish. Roland Barber, who his friends call Mike, says, "Have you ever seen Deliverance?" He equates his family's situation with the movie, depicting four city men who are terrorized by hoodlums from a backwater. "That's what we're up against," Mike says. "Are they or are they not?" Residents of Fayette County, hamlets of Luzerne and Redstone say that Dr. Barber's claims are false and absurd. All of the so-called crimes they've reported to the police don't really pan out. According to Henry Friend, who's 49 years old and a resident of the area for 22 years, he's never seen a single crime that they claim to have happened that seemed to be true. Mr. Friend said the Barbers are trying to whip up public sympathy with their claims of ethnic intimidation. Friend continues that the real issue with the Barbers is not their Judaism, but their operation of a noisy dog kennel that has housed between 40 and 130 dogs. Fayette County court records show that Dr. Barber's wife, Paula, was convicted 15 times last year of causing excessive noise. Each case stemmed from complaints about the kennel situated near the family home. Mrs. Barber is appealing, saying decibel readings show noise created by the dogs is minimal. Mrs. Barber said many of the attacks on her home and animals seemed to coincide with court hearings. Her neighbors, though, said that they've made a point of avoiding her for fear that any innocent crossing of paths could lead to even more allegations. "She wants to make this an anti-Semitism issue," Mr. Friend says. "But the truth is that nobody cares what religion she is. I guarantee nobody in this neighborhood has done a thing to them." And Bruce Richichkar, who's 51, another neighbor, says he knows the Barbers only from zoning and court hearings about their kennel. "I didn't know they were Jewish, and it didn't matter to me," he said. "I just want some peace and quiet." So there you have it. Of course, that's not going to be the end of it if this is the type of thing that goes on and on. Mrs. Barber said that she's convinced they're going to be killed if they stay there. Well, Miss Barber, maybe if you would quit destroying the neighborhood with your dog kennel, which seems to be an act of verbal war against your neighbors, maybe things would calm down for you. Or maybe you could go to the physician and see if maybe you might have a psychiatric condition. That would be useful, especially if you found one. Perhaps you could be medicated and you'd feel much, much better. But to be honest, I hope that you won't do that, because I enjoy stories like this, Mrs. Barber. I find them entertaining, and they really make my day. I mean, I never cease to be amazed at some of the laughable things that come out of the Jewish community, especially when you decide that you want to pretend that you're victims. And in many cases, as we well know, a lot of this victimology is put on, made up, and false. You have a nice day now. The Barbers aren't the only people who have trouble with anti-Semitism. According to an article at Haaretz.com in Israel, The Jews themselves are responsible for the new anti-Semitism, which is the name of an article that has appeared recently in several magazines. According to the author, one day historians will research a fascinating phenomenon, how the State of Israel, which began as a safe haven for survivors of anti-Semitism and genocide, spawned a new anti-Semitism unhindered. The victims of this anti-Semitism are ultra-Orthodox Jews. The perpetrators were secular Jews. Until last week, practically no one would have guessed the author of the above text, but today it's much easier. They're written by a politician, Knesset hopeful Shelley Yakimovich. Shelley published the article 2 years ago when the possibility of Amir Peretz becoming head of the Labor Party seemed even more improbable than Yakimovich's becoming a politician. Her essay, entitled The New Anti-Semites, originally appeared in satirical internet magazine Epis, meaning something in Yiddish. The precursor of the Epis section in the Haaretz Weekend magazine in Hebrew is printed in Hebrew for those of you who just must have everything in its original form. I, however, will just content myself with reading the English translation. And I know absolutely for most of my listeners and readers, that will be more than sufficient, probably more than they would even want to know about. At any rate, this particular article on anti-Semitism plays on the arguments between those who are religious Jews and those who are secular Jews, which is a big problem in the Israeli government. It's almost like the split between blacks and whites in America. The secularists, who are socialists and labor people, cannot stand the religious Jews who are in the country. The religious Jews are really not terribly Zionistic, as Zionists go, although they do live right there in the middle of Zionism. They're more interested in a kind of otherworldly existence, where they don't shop on Shabbat and where they don't want to get involved in wars and so forth, particularly. In fact, believe it or not, Orthodox religious people in Israel don't have to join the army, but everyone else has to, which is extremely interesting. But at any rate, anti-Semitism belongs at home, in Tel Aviv. So when someone tells you you're an anti-Semite, tell them, oh, I beg your pardon, sir, but I just read in Haaretz that the real anti-Semites have to be Jewish people from Israel. In fact, they make the finest anti-Semites. If I were an anti-Semite, I would just have to be an amateur. Oh, and have a nice day. Are we having fun yet? Well, if not, I don't know why. I'm having a good time. Now, I'm trying to show you that knowledge does not have to be boring. The bizarreness of knowledge, especially in the Jewish world, is just unreal almost. In fact, there was a recent article about two unorthodox showmen, Sean Altman and Rod Tannenbaum. They do an annual little get-together show that goes up and down the East Coast around Christmas and Hanukkah that says, what I like about Jew. And that's singular. What I like about Jew, like what I like about you. It's a pun. And, you know, I know some of you don't like puns, but that's the way it is. They call it what I like about Jew. What did Jew want? That type of thing. So what do Jewish people do on Christmas? Well, this story says that the question has been puzzling the non-Hebraic population for years, and perhaps it's time to reveal the secret. For years, the options available to us, members of the tribe, were quite limited, consisting primarily of dining out at a Chinese restaurant. Pretty funny. Since 1998, Rob Tannenbaum and Sean Altman have been providing New Yorkers an alternative to mooshu and egg rolls with their What I Like About Jew review. The vaudeville-style show, with its blend of acoustic music and wittily snarky comedy, has struck a chord with Jewish New Yorkers who flock to the Knitting Factory for a different kind of Christmas celebration. This year's knitting factory shows are at the center of what I like about Jew's Hanukkah length. 8-day, 7-show, East Coast tour. Oh yes, featuring stops in Boston and Washington, D.C. The brainchild of Sean Altman and Rod Tannenbaum, What I Like About Jew, derives its energy from their comedic and musical talent. While immediately identifiable with What I Like About Jew, they may be familiar to audiences from other venues. Altman, for instance, is a skilled singer-songwriter who spent 11 years as a member of the a cappella group Rockapella, appearing regularly on the PBS geography-themed game show, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Oh, I've seen that many times. Before embarking on his solo singing career, Tannenbaum, when not serving as the musical editor of Blender magazine, can be found on VH1, including this evening's So Jewtastic, offering his insight on a variety of Jewish topics. Not for the faint of heart, these two comics take great delight sarcastically tweaking Jewish stereotypes with a scathing and incisive wit designed to amuse the open-minded and offend the stodgy. In discussing What I Like About Jew with Earvolution magazine, it became clear that no sacred cows exist and they are willing to poke fun at anything or anyone. Even their own audience doesn't fall outside of the scope of their humor. And with a sly grin, Tannenbaum notes that he can't even recognize the audience anymore. He said, quote, so many have curly hair and big noses they blend together, unquote. Altman attributes another cause to the audience's homogeneity, saying, quote, the bandages from their recent rhinoplasty, unquote. Now, with their Christmas performances, they often expound on the commercialization of Christmas, especially as it pertains to its exclusion of the Jews, taking aim at the topic long before the traditional media uncovered the so-called War on Christmas. The majority of the show consists of the two collaborative efforts, allowing them to vent their spleen about Jews for Jesus and take gleefully pointed jibes at Jewish rituals like circumcision, like a song called A Little Off the Top, and of course the bar mitzvah, Today I Am a Man. So, there you have it. There you have it. What I Like About Jew. Oh, yeah, baby. While bouncing around in my search engines, looking for bizarre Jewish news, I found something that was just extremely off the wall and over the top, entitled, Churchill Wanted to Execute the Nazis. And it wasn't just that he wanted to execute the Nazis, but that he planned to execute Adolf Hitler in the electric chair if the Nazi leader fell into Allied hands. Can you imagine that? Official documents declassified at the turn of the year reveal that Churchill opposed Allied plans for war crimes trials and wanted summarily to execute leading Nazi figures, including Hitler, whom he regarded as the mainspring of evil and a gangster. The disclosures are contained in the notebooks of Sir Norman Brooke, a wartime deputy cabinet secretary. On July 6, 1942, his notes say that the Prime Minister Churchill himself said, quote, if Hitler falls into our hands, we shall certainly put him to death. Not a sovereign who could be said to be in hands of ministers like Kaiser. This man is the mainspring of evil. The instrument would be the electric chair for gangsters, no doubt, available on Lend-Lease, meaning from the United States. Sir Norman's notebooks reveal Churchill to be a ruthless commander who was prepared to override moral and legal considerations to defeat Germany. On July 7, 1943, Churchill argued passionately that leading Nazis who fell into British hands should be treated as outlaws and shot rather than put on trial. Quote, I suggested that the UN draw up a list of 50 or so who would be declared as outlaws by the 33 nations. Unquote. Now, those not on the list might be induced to rat, and if any of those found by advancing troops The nearest officer of brigade rank could call a military court to establish identity and should then execute without higher authority. Churchill's six-volume history of the conflict, however, the Second World War, doesn't make any reference to the disagreement over trials. Equally controversial would be the revelation in the notebooks that Churchill wanted the Royal Air Force to wipe out German villages in retaliation for the massacre of civilians in Lidice, a Czech village, raised by the SS. Churchill abandoned his plan only in the face of opposition from cabinet colleagues. That must have been quite a cabinet meeting. Oh, really, Winston, you want to wipe out all of the villages of Germany? I think we'll just think about that a little bit before we do it. Next, Churchill, it says, was dismissive of General Charles de Gaulle, who he believed was the greatest living barrier to reunion and restoration of France. So, what do you think, huh? Strap Hitler to an electric chair and zap him. Maybe they could take him down to Florida, put him into old Sparky down there. I think that Churchill would like that. Or maybe we could give it to Churchill for him to use, like Churchill says, using the Lend-Lease Act. Oh, I'm telling you, the news gets more bizarre every day. Well, you know, these racist little Jews in Israel, which is basically occupied Palestine, who themselves are the most anti-Semitic people in the world since they have constantly murdered and imprisoned thousands and thousands of Semites. Because the other Semites, as you know, are the Palestinians and the other Arabs, who are descended from Shem, making them all Semites. This anti-Semitic, fascist Nazi state of Israel never knows when to leave well enough alone, and so earlier this morning, just a few hours ago, they bombed the Fatah building in Gaza, which they said they were leaving so that these people would be able to have their own way there and have their own government. And Fatah is a political organization, and they simply bombed the building. Now, they very dishonestly spread disinformation, as usual, that Fatah is behind the bombings of Israel through artillery shellings from Gaza. But if you believe anything that Israel says, then you must be out of your mind. Now, this is a country that has constantly lied about just about every matter that they've ever had their finger in. So, you know, always be aware when you see something in the paper that, oh, well, these people were killed by such and such terrorists and so forth. And know it for what it is. You're talking about disinformation from the Mossad and from the Israeli disinformation ministries. Some of those ministries include places like the New York Times that is more than happy to repeat what Israel has to say, or what Abraham Foxman has to say, or other of these crafty people who could care less about America but want everything Jewish and Israeli to be shown as absolutely wonderful. So there you have it. In Gaza, just a week or two after the Israelis said they pulled out, their aircraft fired a missile into the Fatah building, which is often used by members of that movement, of President Mahmoud Abbas. Now, can you imagine firing a missile into a building for the organization that supports the president, Mahmoud Abbas? Are you trying to start a war, Israel? Is that what you're trying to do? Don't answer that. I already know what you're trying to do. Yes, you're trying to start a war. You're trying to stir up chaos, because only through chaos can you operate in this world. If there is no chaos anywhere in the world, oh, here comes Israel with chaos. Chaos is very good for those dictators who run Europe and the United States, and I call them dictators because once elected, they can start any war that they want, like in Iraq or Sarajevo. They just go in there and start kicking ass. That's what they do. They're dictators. They are militarists. And one of the ways they're able to do this is to have a country like Israel constantly causing distress in the world, and trying to get enemies like the what they call now the, and this is very racist, the Islamofascists. I believe this word was thought up by Michael Savage from radio. He's a very famous man. And he's, I believe, talked about Jewwatch a few times. And made disparaging remarks, I believe, this is what I heard, I haven't really heard that particular show, but that he's made disparaging remarks about me, about little old me, innocent little Frank Weltner, including the University of Missouri that I attended for 9 years, as though nothing good could come out of the state of Missouri. Well, I can tell you a lot of things that come out of Missouri that are good. How about catfish? And how about Negroes in North St. Louis with the biggest catfish lips you've ever seen? We've got tons of things here. We have the largest contingent, in many ways, of the National Vanguard and National Alliance. We have VNN up in Kirksville. We have all sorts of communities where people live by themselves, like some of the Christian Identity cities and hamlets that are found within the Ozarks and in the wine valleys, where they have really excellent grape wines that are produced here in Missouri, which are world famous for their bouquet and for their taste, for their presentation. This is a great state. And the University of Missouri, I admit, it's not any big shakes, but you know what? They got the same professors at the University of Missouri that they have at Harvard, that they have at Chapel Hill in North Carolina, that they have at Berkeley, that they have at Stanford University. In fact, there are professors from those universities teaching at the University of Missouri. But let's not even go there. I don't feel like being a alumni fundraiser for the University of Missouri, but I'll tell you what. When I went there years ago, the tuition was very, very reasonable. I believe it was only $17. And for a boy to go up there without any money from a farm, and people up there would take care of them, find them a place to live, find them a job, and give them loans so they could go to school, and 4 or 5 years later they'd have a degree, become successful businessmen. Hey, you can't beat it. This is a great state, and I'd like to thank the state of Missouri for providing me the opportunity of a university education. And I'll tell you this, Mr. Michael Savage, with your stuck-up Jewish nose from New York, I'll tell you this. You went to Berkeley, the commie school over there in California. You know, you have absolutely no reason to put down anybody else's university when you went to one of the flimsiest educational institutions filled with communists and propagandists. I don't know how you became a faux conservative and a Judeo or neocon. You know, you must have just been a very bitter person, and no matter where you went, you would do just the opposite, which is good. And by the way, Mr. Savage, I love your show. I think it's great. And I hope you stay on the air for many, many years, because I find you extremely entertaining. The day just wouldn't seem right without another announcement of a racist, pro-Semitic Jewish race rally, such as the one that's going to occur in just a week or so down in good old New Orleans. Yes, the Jewish community is going to come back to New Orleans, and even though it's been hard hit by Hurricane Katrina, with widespread damage to heavily populated Jewish residential communities and their synagogues and offices of the major Jewish organizations, they're going to come back there and they're going to start things up again and have a race rally there. Jews only. They're going to feature faith in the music of Jewish rocker Rick Resht. And they're going to try to reunite the New Orleans Jewish community as the New Orleans Jewish Community Center reopens with a Welcome Back to New Orleans celebration. Well, I don't imagine too many Goyim are going to be there, or too many Gentiles. And if a white group did this, let's say the Ku Klux Klan was welcoming the white community back to New Orleans, well, you can just imagine what the Jewish newspapers would be saying. But this is okay because, hey, this is these are Jewish people, and Jewish people, you know, they're victims. They were the Only ones hurt by the hurricane. Oh, poor us, the little victims. I'm surprised that the Jewish Community Center hasn't accused the hurricane of being anti-Semitic. I mean, after all, it says they've suffered heavy damage in these Jewish residential communities. So the hurricane obviously has to be an anti-Semitic hurricane. And I think if I were the author of this story, I would, if I were a good Jew, I'd say, this was the most anti-Semitic act of nature that we have ever seen. Look at our synagogues. Look at our Jewish homes. Look what's happened. You know, our shekels in the basement, you know, are covered with mud. I'll have to clean them off before I can count them again. Or whatever. Whatever. Now, the New Orleans Jewish Community Center is beginning this process of rebuilding the Jewish community, says Arlene Barron. She's the executive director of the New Orleans Jewish Community Center. Gee, that just sounds so racist to me, Arlene. Aren't you embarrassed? I mean, the New Orleans Jewish Community Center, that's really racial. I'm worried about you, Arlene. I'm afraid you're one of those little Jewish racists down there in the South. You are, aren't you? You're the director of the New Orleans Jewish Community Center. What kind of a racist is that that would be an executive director of a Jewish place? I thought you were for diversity. I thought you were for blacks and for whites and for Arabs and for Chinese and for Mexicans, and you're the director of a New Orleans Jewish Community Center, my dear? And you're celebrating the return of Jews to their homes with a Welcome Back Jews party featuring Rick Resch? It almost sounds like Rick Reich. And you say that it's fitting that the Jewish Community Center brings our community together? Well, you also say here, look, we look forward to inspiring Jewish journeys for future generations. You're racist, aren't you, Arlene? Come on. Come on, you spent your life now thinking about everything Jewish. We've seen such faith, determination, strength, and hope to the citizens in New Orleans. That's what Rick Reck says. We, meaning we Jews, we racist Jews. Because, see, you can't be for Jews, Mr. Resch, and not be racist if you can't be for whites and not be racist. So you're a little racist, aren't you? Come on, fess it up now. You and Arlene are going to have this little racist get-together down there in New Orleans. And that anti-Semitic hurricane has done you wrong. Yes, it has. Now, it says here that the Jewish Federation calculated the Jewish population in New Orleans at approximately 13,000 in 1984. And on pre-Katrina population statistics, it was approximately 9,500. And you say here that 40% of the Jewish community has already returned to New Orleans. And they expect the number to continue climbing. What do you think, Rick and Arlene? You want some more blacks to come back there? How about the ones that smoke crack? That are responsible for the 600 or so murders that occur in New Orleans every year? And that now occur in other cities thanks to the hurricane? Because they've been scattered all the way from California to New York, taking their drug addictions and their criminality with them. You try to get them back to their Arlene and Rick? Well, we'll see. I bet you're going to talk about it. I bet you'll put up a good talk, but I bet you'd really rather have a bunch of those rich white people down there. You know, those Gentiles that are non-black. I bet you'd love to have that. But you'd probably want to have some Mexicans and some blacks to mow your lawns, I guess. Yeah, because you're good people. You're good people, and I respect you. In fact, I think I'm going to show up down there at your racist Jewish rally. I might even take pictures and publish them. I might do that. I might learn from you how to have a racist rally. I need to bone up on that sort of thing. You guys have your own country, your own racist country in Israel. I bet you're the people that could teach me the most about how to have a nice racist rally. Yeah, I think I'll go down there. But I'm a little afraid. I mean, I'm not afraid physically, but I'm afraid that I'll drive 650 miles down there, and when you find out that I'm the librarian for Jew Watch, you do something real racist and intimidating and hateful and tell me that I have to leave, that I'm not welcome because I'm too diverse. You know, my little Jewish friends have been putting up this racist apartheid wall in occupied Palestine, which their military jingoists have been able to override now for about the last 65 years. And they've been kind of running roughshod over those little Palestinians and their Jewish anti-Semitism against Arabs, who are the other Semitics, because they too are Semites. And the Jews in Israel just don't like these Semites who are Arabs. They like the Semites who are Jewish, but don't like the Arab Semites, and they're very anti-Semitic about them. And so now they built this 26-foot-high wall out of concrete, and it goes on and on and on. I believe it's even going to be longer than the Great Wall of China. Now, they don't call it a wall. They call it different things that are, you know, kind of clever. Like, the new Israeli security barrier is one of the phrases they use. They don't call it an apartheid wall. It's going to be a 450-mile barrier. And it was conceived in 2002 to protect Israel from terrorists. Well, that's not exactly true. It was actually built by the Israelis to protect themselves from the patriots who live in the occupied Palestine that they're trying to garner for themselves. But that's just the way that people talk about stuff, and we're going to talk about Jew speak here pretty soon, as a matter of fact. But I think that the Jews ought to start really pushing this wall. I mean, it's 26 feet tall, and it's just, you know, kind of oppressive. If, like, if you're in Bethlehem and there's a wall all around you and you can't see out, it's just like you're in a prison. Can you imagine looking out of your house and two or three blocks away you see this wall 26 feet high that surrounds your city and you can't get out without going through a checkpoint where there are guards who then frisk you and slap you around and maybe let you out. Maybe they say, well, today we're going to keep it closed. You can't go to work. You can't get out. And that's what this wall is like. But I think that if I were marketing for Israel, you know what I'd do? Oh, I'd be better than the Jews. I would call it the Great Wall of Israel. Come visit the Great Wall of Israel. And I'd put up some tourist shacks all along, you know, where people could come and buy trinkets and little pieces of the wall, and maybe some little dolls and statues of dead Palestinians with blood pouring from their broken limbs. That would be really good. The tourists could really enjoy themselves with something like that. And they could eat stolen Arab food, and they could stay in a stolen Arab home that was absconded by Israel after the 1947 war. And you say, here, live in this overnight in this stolen Palestinian home and get the real flavor of Israel now that you've seen the Great Wall. I think we could make something out of this. This could be really big. Now, my little Jewish friends, I know how you love to pretend that you're the victim. You love to play the victim. Oy vey, look what's happened to me. Somebody called me a Jew. Somebody called me a kike, whatever. Whatever it is. And no one knows if it's true or not. It's just your word for it. And I would imagine that there's probably hundreds of false statements that people called me a kike, because I've never heard anybody look at a Jew and say, you kike, I can't stand. No one has ever done that in my presence. And I'm supposed to be around people that would do that sort of thing. I know there's a Jewish lawyer here that I work with at my radio station, and he said that the Jews ask him, well, you know the man who's the librarian for Jew Watch? And I say, yes. And they say, well, what's he like? Thinking that you're some wretched denizen or some thug. And he says, well, you wouldn't believe it. He's as nice and respectful to me as anybody else. You wouldn't know that he is the editor of Jew Watch. He seems like just a normal individual. Because I would never call somebody a name like that. Just because politically you don't like Jews because of their politics and the way that they're in the White House and they're forcing your kids to go over and get their limbs shot off in Iraq doesn't mean that the Jew down the street from you has anything at all to do with it. And, you know, if I were talking to a Jew in the White House, I wouldn't say it either. Those that are responsible. You know, if I were talking to, let's say, William Pearl, or if I were talking to Ari Fleischer, or if I were talking to Wolfowitz, I wouldn't call him a kike. I wouldn't do anything like that. It's just something that white people normally do not do, unless they're really different. I mean, I just haven't met anybody that would do that. But at any rate, I was reading an article entitled Jews Target of Most Hate Crimes in U.S., and it was from the Ecumenical News International at Oxford, Ohio. And I don't know, these ecumenicals, the Anglican Church of Canada, and I don't know why they have this in Oxford, Ohio, but I guess there's some reason. Anyway, the article, which is dated in Oxford, Ohio, is where it was written, says that Jews remain by far the greatest target of religious-based hate crimes in the United States in 2004. And this was according to a recently released report by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which I think is a tremendous disinformation agency. I mean, they've had all sorts of charges against them. They were fixing evidence, putting people in jail, and they were even killed because of evidence that was doctored in the laboratories of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They've been known to follow Martin Luther King Jr. around and other people, to infiltrate organizations. I mean, this is a very hateful organization, the FBI. At any rate, the FBI recorded 1,374 incidents of religion-oriented hate crimes in 2004. And get this, 950 of those, actually 954 of those, were directed at Jews. Now, Barbara Balzer, the national chairperson of the Anti-Defamation League, a group that aims to secure justice and fair treatment to all citizens. Oh, yeah, right. I'd never noticed you were doing that for white people particularly, or for blacks, or for Chinese. I mean, every once in a while you might step forward, but pretty much you're for Jews, aren't you, Barbie? Anyway, Barbara Balzer says, this report always serves as a wake-up call that hate crime remains a national problem in America. Well, let's see. Is it a problem? You had 1,374 incidents of religion-oriented hate crimes. Now, let me pull up my calculator here on my computer, and I'm going to type in, there's 300 million people in America. 300,000,000, I'm going to hit the division mark, and I'm going to divide that by these hate crimes, 1,374. This means that you would have to meet 218,340 people. 218,340 people this year before you would find one that was a victim of a hate crime. And most of these hate crimes are just somebody calling somebody a name. And so, you know, there's really not any violence that takes place. There were other people that were victims of so-called hate. And what is a victim of hate? I mean, if you don't like Jews, you don't like Jews. Is that hate? Or is it just discrimination, that you're discriminating? Do you have to like everybody? Oh, I'm going to bring some Somalis in here with a bone in their nose, and you're going to like them, or I'm going to call you a hater. See, I think this is all a bunch of bunk. It's a bunch of bunk. And these 1,374 incidents of religion-oriented crimes were based on data from 12,711 local law enforcement agencies, which means only 1 in 10 of them had any kind of religious-based hate crime. And a lot of them were just verbal, or it was somebody, you know, putting a little mark on a building or a car or something, I don't know. Who knows? Nothing big. Nothing big at all. Now, I took a look at this, and I wrote a headline on it. And what I did was I divided the 9 million Jews in the country by the 954 Jewish religiously-oriented hate crimes. You know what I came up with? I came up with this, that only one Jew in 10,000 were hate crime victims in 2004. One Jew in 10,000 were hate victims. 2004. So, Miss Balzer, You should be rejoicing that what a wonderful country this is. That it's almost impossible to find a Jew that was a victim of a hate crime. I've never seen a Jew that was a victim of a hate crime. Ever. I've heard of them, but I have never seen one. And as a matter of fact, I think most of these hate crimes are lies by people. Like the barbers there who their neighbors say that they are basically painting swastikas on our house or whatever they're doing in order to get sympathy. And we've seen a lot of that. Like here in St. Louis, at the JCCA, the Jewish Community Center, there was some swastikas and stuff painted on their building. Oh, oy vey, we're a victim. It was a hate crime. Guess what? It turned out it was their own teenagers that did it for fun. But if our teenagers, who are non-Jewish, did it for fun, oh, they'd have a hate crime against them. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you guys, you know, you really need to, you're very psychiatric and you need to go to a medical institution for some help. I mean, anybody who constantly looks for some reason to stand up and say that they're a victim, when in fact only one Jew in 10,000 were hate crime victims in 2004, there's something wrong with you folks mentally. You guys have got a problem. You really do. And as a matter of fact, as I showed you from the calculator, only one person in 218,000 people in America per year are a victim of a religious hate crime. There are only 1,300 of them in the whole year. 1,300 out of 300 million people. Now, Ms. Balzer of the ADL, you need to take up cooking and sewing. And Abe Foxman, you need to go back to France where you were raised by that Catholic French lady. And you need to you need to learn French again and find something else to do, like become a wine taster or something. I mean, you've been whining so long, I bet you'd be an excellent wine taster. You must have a wine list a mile long, Mr. Foxman, as the national director of the ADL. Because I hear you in the newspaper shouting at the top of your lungs about this and that supposed hate crime. It's getting real old. You understand that? Mr. Foxman and Ms. Balzer, it's getting really, really old. And you need to find some other way to make money. I mean, that little rusty tin cup that you're bringing around for the ADL, you know, it's ridiculous. And it's beginning to come back on you. There's a backlash that has come against you recently that is just unbelievable. And when you keep saying that the sky is falling and nothing happens, when you keep saying you're a victim of religious hate, and as a matter of fact, only 1 in 10,000 of you had any problem, and in the whole country, only 1 out of 218,000 had any religious problem, you have got a psychiatric problem, my dear. You need to get yourself some help. Would you do that for me? Would you do that for Jew Watch? Would every member of the ADL please go to a psychiatrist and get some medication? Because your analysis of what's going on, based on the factual substance of so few religious hate crimes, most of which are just somebody calling your name probably, your people need some medication. You're over the top. Come on. Do yourself a favor. Swallow your pride. Go to one of those nice Jewish psychiatrists and get yourself a little blue pill. Thank you. I'd like to get away from this fake religious hate crime issue that the ADL loves to talk about. But before I do, there was another article this week in the Miami Herald, which is, I consider, a pro-Jewish racist newspaper if there ever was one. It's probably one of these little commie-type things, too, because it's down there in Florida where all these socialists from New York go down there to retire, and they have to serve those people. And in the article, it says that 334 Jews were offended by somebody. They had hate crimes that were committed against them. And that it had risen 21%, which, you know, meant there were a few more of them, which is not that many. I mean, it's just a minuscule number. In fact, since I know you have an inquiring mind, I'm going to tell you what the number is. It's about 70 more people in a year in the whole state of Florida, where there's 580,000 Jews. And I got that figure from demographic surveys of the different states. 580,000 Jews. And out of that 580,000 Jews, there were only 334 religious incidents. And probably, you got, you know, one of you got mad at somebody and you were doing this and that, and somebody said, "Don't give me that, get out of here, you Jew." Just something stupid like that. You know, that amounted to nothing. You know, like road rage or restaurant rage or something. You know, they probably could tell by your accent that you were Jewish and you were acting absolutely crazy. And they said, "Listen, you big Jew, get the hell out of here," and then you called it a hate crime. "Oh, you discriminate against me because I'm Jewish." Well, listen, get over it. You know, you people are really mentally ill. You go in these countries and you try to act like you're being victimized by people. I think people have a right to not like you because you're Jewish. You have a right not to like me because I'm Christian. You have that right. You have a right not to like blacks. You have a right not to like spaghetti. You have a, whatever it is that you don't like. If you don't like brick houses, you have a right not to like them and to express it. To tell somebody who owns a brick house, "I don't like your brick house, and I don't like you because you live in a brick house." Now, under the Jewish laws that you've promulgated here so that you can pretend that you're a victim and send innocent white people to jail for doing almost nothing, and this ridiculous phrase, hate crime, that's stupid. Get over it. You people are mentally, you're psychiatric is what you are. You're psychiatric. You have to be telling somebody what a victim you are. "Oh, I was so put upon. Somebody called me a kike," or "somebody called me a Jew in public and brought my religion up to my face." What, were you wearing a skull cap? Well, what if I wore a big Christian cross and then I started acting like a jerk in front of you? Wouldn't you call me a stupid Christian? And so somebody probably called you a stupid Jew, you call the sheriff, and it's reported as a hate crime. You know what? There's so many sheriffs around. There's 12,000 sheriffs. And there are like 1,300 hate crimes in America. That's only one hate crime for every 10 sheriffs. Get over it. And that isn't even the number that were for Jews. There were others that were for other things. Get over it. You're not the center of the universe. Understand? Quit talking about this stuff. Quit having organizations that run around stirring this up like the ADL. That's going to come back and bite you on the rear end. People don't like hearing this stuff, especially when it's so stupid. Like when a little menorah gets hammered to the ground by some 14-year-old, you go absolutely nuts, like it's some indication that white people are related to Adolf Hitler or something. Get over it. You know, there was a thing where a menorah was knocked down and two mailboxes. Well, it's not a hate crime to knock down the two mailboxes, but another material object, a menorah, that's a hate crime. Doesn't make any difference. It's both the same activity. Somebody destroyed something. Somebody vandalized something. But you want to make a big deal out of it because you're Jewish and you love to play the victim. And some of you make this stuff up and you know you do. Because you just get off on it. You're a minority and I want you to act like it. Go sit in the corner and lick your wrist and be quiet and don't talk to us. We should never hear from you. You are a guest here. You're only 2%. You're 1 out of 50. Go in the corner and shut up. We don't want to hear from you anymore. We don't wish you any harm, but we just don't want to be with you because of the things that you try to do to us. We find you abhorrent because of your activities and your complaining. Sit in the corner and shut up and act like the minority that you are. And get a grip on yourself. Go to a physician. Find a nice Jewish one. I doubt if you can find a Gentile one in America. They're either going to be Jewish or they're going to be somebody from Nigeria. I haven't seen a white doctor in years. Go find yourself a nice Jewish psychiatrist and get yourself some nice little blue pills. And quit complaining. Surely you remember how, over the last few weeks, we've been talking about the ADL's attack on Christianity. Among other things, they've said that the Jews should find it very dangerous that the Christians are beginning to organize politically to try to get their share of influence in the White House and in Congress. Of course, the Jews have always had more than their share with the Jewish lobby, which is basically IPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee. And that committee has now attacked the Bush administration over its handling of the Iranian nuclear question. And the viciousness of their attack, according to Haaretz.com, is unprecedented. It took the shape of a broad media campaign that included press releases and targeted members of Congress. Now, last week, the Washington Post, which is read by the top political echelon in the Capitol, noted that this is the first time that IPAC has issued broad and open criticism of the Bush administration. In a background paper that IPAC officials distributed among members of Congress, the pro-Israel lobby describes Bush's recent policy decisions on Iran as dangerous and disturbing, and even claims that they are actually helping Iran to achieve nuclear capability. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, which mounted a similar offensive, refrained from directly criticizing the president and called on its member groups to exert pressure on Congress and foreign governments and to send letters to top administration officials. Earlier, organization leaders like Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League had argued that this issue should not be made into a Jewish struggle like the fight for Soviet Jewry in the past or the fight against Palestinian terrorism. Well, that doesn't sound much like Abe Foxman. Usually he's trying to fight for the Jews and gets himself all tied up in his verbiage. What's the matter, Abe? Did you blow it on the Christmas question which you lost, huh, buddy? Did you blow it? Is everybody looking at you now, so you decided to kind of back off of this one and let the other Jews take the heat for a while? But take a look at this. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations sounds very highfalutin, doesn't it? No, it's just a bunch of Jews sitting around a table or in a room being manipulated by other Jews who already know the outcome of what they're going to vote for. They all decided, like their leader said, that they're going to mount a similar offensive that will exert pressure on Congress and foreign governments, that they're going to send letters to top administration officials, etc. This is the way the Jews operate. They'll get a cadre of maybe 500 to 700 people writing letters, and pretty soon things start to happen. People don't like to have their mail file tickled by a bunch of angry Jewish people, and more than likely they have a good chance of getting their way when that happens. But IPAC has a much more militant line, and they're consciously deciding to criticize the White House, simply because the administration decided last month to accept the more conciliatory Russian approach to Iran, which recommended avoiding an open confrontation, especially in the Security Council of the UN for the time being. That's not good enough for the Jews. I think they really do want war. I do. I think they'd like to see the United States invade Syria and Iran. And they don't know what they're going to get if they get Hillary in there or a Democrat of any type, because the Democrats haven't gone to war very much recently. So they probably figure this is it for them. And the Republicans are in a very dangerous situation because President Bush doesn't have very good statistics right now, and these senators and representatives are going to have to run for office as well as governors. And since the Jews own the media, if the president and the Congress doesn't do exactly what they want, they can control the election. Now, we don't really have a true democracy here. We have a Jewish oligarchy where the Jews tell us everything that we think and feel and hear. They whisper into our ear through the radios, the television sets, the newspapers, the magazines. And we see everything through this Zionist Jewish lens. And if anybody says anything against what they say, then they call you some bad word like anti-Semite. When somebody like myself stands up and simply reads what the Jews have been saying and prints it on the internet and gives links to it, Well, they practically have a cow. They start calling people, complaining. You know, you Jewish people, I mean, you're like little babies, actually. You want everything your way. Either that or you're going to pound on the floor. I think you're mentally ill. I really do. I think that any race of people that acts like this has got some real issues. This story says in Haaretz that anyone observing the political trends and moods in the American Jewish community cannot but raise an eyebrow over what seems to be a split personality. Yeah, schizophrenia. Alongside the massive attack on the passiveness the Bush administration is demonstrating and everything related to Iran, the media, especially the Jewish press, gave extensive coverage last week to the results of an annual survey conducted by the American Jewish Committee. The survey reported that 70% of American Jews oppose the U.S. involvement in Iraq, an opposition rate that is about 10% higher than among the general public. After refraining until now from publicly expressing opposition to the war, several Jewish organizations have also openly decided to come out against it. So the Jews are split on this. But these organizations and their leaders are so pro-Zionist that they are not going to follow their membership. They're there not to follow the membership, not to represent them, but to lead them down the primrose path to hell if necessary, to world war if necessary. And they're prepared to do it. That's what their power is all about. The elitist Jewish supremacist and these people at the top of these organizations are true supremacists, true Zionists. They don't care if the whole world is embroiled in a war and hundreds of millions of people are slaughtered in it, as long as Israel comes out on top. The decline in the popularity of the war led the Reform Movement of Jews to issue a call for its annual convention last month for all American forces to be pulled out of Iraq. This decision generated a public dispute on the pages of the New York Times when a Republican Jewish group published a giant advertisement in support of Bush and criticized the decision by the Reform Movement. Well, nobody knows what's going to happen in Iraq. I forecasted the moment we went in so fast that we'd already lost the war, that the army wasn't going to fight, they were going to bury their weapons and come back and pick us to death, which is what they're doing, until finally we leave. Because we don't know how to fight a war, and we've proven that in all of the wars that we've had. So, there you have it. IPAC is stirring up trouble against the Bush administration. And the American Jews are showing their split personality. They are a huge force of people. They're not homogeneous. They're basically they're heterogeneous. They come from many different areas. And so we can expect them to have a split like this. But remember that just because they have a split doesn't mean that they're not dangerous. There's a split in the Iranian people. Some are for the religious democracy, some are for a dictatorship, some are for secularism. This is true in all countries, but these countries and these people are still dangerous. And we do need to keep our eye on them. And they have been up to no good as far as America has been concerned for many, many decades. And to allow a race of people and a tribe of people and a religion of people like the Jews to control over 90% of our press, our media, our entertainment, and to manipulate us with it so that we don't even have our own country anymore because we don't even see what's going on because all we see is what the Jews want us to see. It's vicious. It's vicious. They have no respect for the Gentiles of this world. They will take everything if they can get their hands on it. And in terms of the media, they have taken everything. And soon, I'm afraid, they're going to try to take the internet. I keep reading where these Jews buy up more and more of these internet properties, like they control AOL and Time Warner. They control Earthlink. They control all of this stuff. Murdoch just bought Space.com. He's Jewish. His mother was a Jew. Her name was Elizabeth Joy Green. And millions of people go to Space.com with their blogs. By controlling these things, they can ask people to leave their particular organization and say, well, we don't want you to be on AOL anymore. We don't want you to be on space.com. They can do whatever they want. And they're into control, and we have to remember that, and that makes them a very, very dangerous people. The little guy isn't, and the little guy does want to get out of Iraq, but the big guys, those elitists, those Jewish supremacists, they want control. They're the people we have to watch. There was an article this week that I found extremely interesting, and it was at ZNet, which is where you have zmag.org. And it's a story called Telling It Like It Isn't by Robert Fisk, who's been an Israeli reporter for years. He said, I first realized the enormous pressures on American journalists in the Middle East when I went home some years ago to say goodbye to a colleague from the Boston Globe. I expressed my sorrow that he was leaving a region where he had obviously enjoyed reporting. I could save my sorrows for someone else, he said. One of the joys of leaving was that he would no longer have to alter the truth to suit his paper's more vociferous readers. I used to call the Israeli Likud Party right-wing, he said, but recently my editors have been telling me not to use the phrase. A lot of our readers objected, and so now I asked, we just don't call it right-wing anymore. Ouch. I knew that at once these readers were reviewed in his newspapers as Israel's friends. But I also knew that the Likud under Benjamin Netanyahu was as right-wing as it had ever been. This is only the tip of the semantic iceberg that has crashed into American journalism in the Middle East. Illegal Jewish settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab land are clearly colonies, and we used to call them that. I cannot trace the moment when we started using the word settlements, but I can remember the moment around 2 years ago when the word settlements was replaced by Jewish neighborhoods, and even in some cases outposts. Similarly, occupied Palestine land was softened in many American media reports into disputed Palestinian land, just after then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, in 2001, instructed U.S. embassies in the Middle East to refer to the West Bank as disputed rather than occupied territory. Then there's the wall, the massive concrete obstruction whose purpose, according to the Israeli authorities, is to prevent Palestinian suicide bombers from killing innocent Israelis. In this, it seems to have had some success, but it does not follow the line of Israel's 1967 border, and cuts deeply into Arab land. And all too often these days, journalists call it a fence rather than a wall, or a security barrier, which is what the Israelis prefer themselves to say. For some of its length, we are told it is not a wall at all, so we cannot call it a wall, even though the vast snake of concrete and steel that runs east of Jerusalem is higher than the old Berlin Wall. The semantic effect of this journalistic obfuscation is clear. If Palestinian land is not occupied, but merely part of a legal dispute that might be resolved in law courts or discussions over tea, then a Palestinian child who throws a stone at an Israeli soldier in this territory is clearly acting insanely. If a Jewish colony built illegally on Arab land is simply a nice, friendly neighborhood, then any Palestinian who attacks it must be carrying out a mindless terrorist act. And surely there is no reason to protest a fence or a security barrier. Words that conjure up the fence around a garden are the gate arm at the entrance to a private housing complex. For Palestinians to object violently to any of these phenomena thus marks them as generically vicious people. By our use of the language, we condemn them. We follow these unwritten rules elsewhere in the region. American journalists frequently used the words of U.S. officials in the early days of the Iraqi insurgency, referring to those who attacked American troops as rebels or terrorists or remnants of the former regime. The language of the Second Proconsul from the United States in Iraq, L. Paul Bremer III, was taken up obediently and grotesquely by American journalists. American television, meanwhile, continues to present war as a bloodless sandpit in which the horrors of conflict, The mutilated bodies of the victims of aerial bombing, torn apart in the desert by wild dogs, are kept off the screen. Editors in New York and London make sure that viewers' sensitivities don't suffer, that we don't indulge in the pornography of death, which is exactly what war is, or dishonor the dead whom we have just killed. Our prudish video coverage makes war easier to support, and journalists long ago became complicit with governments in making conflict and death more acceptable to viewers. Television journalism has become a lethal adjunct to war. Back in the old days, we used to believe, did we not, that journalists should tell it how it is. Read the great journalism of World War II and you'll see what I mean. The Ed Murrows and Richard Dimbleby's, the Howard K. Smiths and Alan Moorheads didn't mince their words or change their descriptions or run mealy-mouthed from the truth because listeners or readers didn't want to know or preferred a different vision. So, let's call a colony a colony. Let's call occupation what it is. Let's call a wall a wall. And maybe express the reality of war by showing that it represents not primarily victory or defeat, but the total failure of the human spirit. Robert Fisk is Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, and the author most recently of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, published last month by Knopf. And so we can see that the Jewish supremacists and their ownership of the presses have reconstructed the language so that things that go on in Israel by the Zionists are reported in a nice, mild manner. And they twist things so that occupied Palestine becomes a place where people would love to live, when as a matter of fact there is blood and gore on almost every street of that particularly unfortunate land. I just love the way these armed forts, or fortresses that are in Palestine, are called settlements. They're actually invading colonialists who take land, put a wall around it, and make sure that the aboriginals who live around them cannot destroy them or shoot at them because they are surrounded by walls. This is what we did to the Indians. We placed these fortresses with walls around them, close to their villages, and then we slowly wiped them out, enslaved them, or move them to a reservation. And this is what the Jews are doing in occupied Palestine to the natives there. They are building reservations for them with walls around them. The Israelis no longer have a wall around Israel. No, the wall is around Palestine, around each city, so that the people are sequestered inside their homes, under house arrest, and the Jewish military authorities are in control. Yet through Jew speak in our media, which is owned by Jews, which is a great danger to our people, these things are sanitized and portioned out to us as though everything is, oh, just all right. And please remain calm. We are in control and we will help you. Well, a matter of fact, the help that we've gotten is a war in Iraq, a busted economy, and a people here in America who are very unhappy with the situation of a lying president controlled by neocons. Our country has been taken away from us, and the Jewish elitists, the Jewish supremacists are running it. These people are insane. They are filled with the idea that they are victims. And as a matter of fact, they have throughout their history made victims of everybody else in the world. And I can assure you that the boys and girls who are getting their limbs blown off in Iraq are absolute victims of Jewish hegemony and tyranny. Thank you very much for listening to The World Today. Please visit JewWatch at least once a day, if not twice. Only in this way can you keep abreast of Jewish news. JewWatch investigates 200 to 300 Jewish news stories a day to bring you particular news stories which we know will be of interest to you. We wish you a hearty farewell, and we want you to have a very, very nice day.